Hey, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about web security. So last time we talked about sort of the basics of how web browsers and websites work, and we have this notion of stateless requests that you request a URL, we send a command saying, I want to get this URL, I want to post some data to this URL, and that's it. That's the baseline, is that that's independent, that stands alone. And we added this extra feature, something like cookies, which was sort of bolted on after the fact, which is how we actually tie those requests together and have features that you expect every website to have these days, like being able to log in, have the website remember when you go to some random page that you're logged in. We also talked about, in this model, sort of some security concerns. We talked about two issues. So one was client versus server trust, that people get in trouble by assuming that because they wrote the web page, that they can trust what that web page does, but it's running on, sometimes, the attacker's browser. And you can't trust the attacker's browser. The attacker can make their browser do whatever they like. We also talked about XSS, which is just a funny name for command injection, where in our command language is not shell or SQL, but is HTML. And so we have these two attack scenarios. So the first attack scenario we started with was this client versus server trust. This is where the attacker runs a web browser and communicates with the vulnerable website, and our vulnerable website is just too trusting. So maybe the vulnerable website lets us say, yeah, the price of that product, it's zero. I know what you, the web page you gave me didn't say it was zero, but I corrected it for you. Here you go. Or when we say, yeah, you want to send to this email, don't worry about those funny characters, just put them in the command and run that. So we're trusting the attacker too much. And we have this second situation, which is what we'll talk about more today, and we talked about with cross-site scripting as the problem, where the victim is the web browser and the website. So somehow our attacker is going to fool our victim's web browser into doing things with a website that we don't want to happen as the website designer. So with cross-site scripting, the victim visits our attacker's website somehow, or gets an email from our attacker with a link or something like that. And the attacker sends back some commands, like HTML or something like that, to do something with the victim website. And this causes our victim's web browser to send a request the attacker chooses. So a link the attacker chooses, a form the attacker chooses, or some script the attacker runs, which gets an image the attacker chooses, any sort of thing which needs to access this victim website that the attacker wants to do something bad with. And in our cross-site scripting example, the bad thing which happened is that the victim website sent back some JavaScript that had some injected command chosen by the attacker. So now we get to run, as the attacker, things in the context of the victim website. So the attacker website is getting to put things in the victim website and run scripting code, which it turns out can do things that the attacker website is not allowed to do normally. And one example we had was getting things like session IDs, which are basically equivalent to a password. When you've logged in, your session ID makes you logged in, just like a password would make you log in. And the attacker can send some code to say, just send that to me, please. And because the web browser, the victim's web browser, sees it coming from the victim website, it's going to trust that. And it's going to do what it says. So to make this more concrete, I'm going to be daring and try to do a demo here. So here I have a simple little web app, and I have a debugging window here where I can type in some value, you know, something, submit it, and it shows it at the top. And this is sort of the classic scenario where we might have cross-site scripting if I forgot to check whether that contained HTML tags. So how would I tell if I did that? How would you check? Yeah, like
a div or something.
What?
A div or something.
Yeah, so you can just put in, you know, some HTML and see, yeah, that seems to get rendered as HTML. So probably we have a problem here. And this is the sort of thing that our attacker can exploit. They can realize, I can send something and get it back as HTML. That means when you visit my completely innocent website that's completely unrelated, I can give you a link like that inserts some HTML by basically pre-filling out the form. So in this case, the form is a GET request, so I can use a URL. There's some other methods we can use if it's not a GET request. So in this case here, I'm putting in a script tag, which shows an annoying dialog box. Just a demonstration. This is classically what people use to say, you're vulnerable to cross-site scripting. But our real attacker would probably just silently send this secret session ID here, that this web page happens to display, somewhere. And I never see anything. And another thing I mentioned about cross-site scripting is that, you know, the easiest thing to imagine is that someone gives you a link to this, to the victim website that you go to, which has the injected code. So you know you're going to the website when maybe from a place you're not supposed to, so maybe you could figure it out. But it can be way more subtle than that. So here's a page which loads my cookie ID from the other website. And there's nothing visible. And this is using that cross-site scripting bug. So if we want to see what's going on here, we can look at the source code here in a readable font size. And I just have a way of embedding a web page. So I can iframe as a way in HTML saying, I want to put a web page in another web page. So I said, you know, like the calendar widget. So I said, yeah, I have this widget here I want to put in, and it just happens to have this big script command here. And I even set it to not display. That is perfectly valid. If I couldn't set it to not display, I could make it really well hidden. I could like put it at the bottom of the web page in really tiny font and a really small box that you never see. But I can just set it not to display, and it still loads that cross-site scripting. And if I were the attacker, instead of displaying annoying dialogue, I'd probably just send the cookie to my web server by like loading an image, as we mentioned. So,
guess what? Equivalent of permissions on cookies?
So the question is, are there no equivalent of permissions on cookies? Okay, so let's talk about that. And I have a slide for this. So cookies have fields, and I showed a slide for this last time. And one of the fields is the domain. And this is the primary means by which cookies are normally restricted. So cookies have this domain field, which says, what domain do you send them to? And this applies to scripts, too. So that's why I had to use this iframe and inject something in that web app, loading that web app, rather than just getting at the cookie directly. So I had to be going from the right domain.
There's nothing client-side stuff.
So there's nothing client-side by default. But there are some mitigations which are sort of added on later. So the history here is, first we had the web without cookies. No one cared about logins. You just wanted to display static web pages. Then people started caring about logins, and they added cookies, and then cross-site scripting became a problem. And then they started worrying about what can we do to make, you know, especially cookies, which matter, and you can get out with cross-site scripting, be less of an issue. And probably the mitigation that's sort of most related to what you're asking for is something called HTTP-only cookies. So in addition to saying this cookie is for Facebook.com and not any other website, you can say this cookie is HTTP-only, which means I don't want you to give it to scripts. Scripts should never have this cookie. They don't need it. Just send it to me when you ask for web pages, but don't give it to code on my web pages. They don't need it. And I don't want to risk that I put bad code there because of cross-site scripting, and they'll have access to it. So that's sort of the closest equivalent to the sort of permissions you talked about. There also are other, why do I forget where this slide is? Pull up there. There's also this path field, which seems like it would also help us restrict where cookies go. So we could have all our pages start with slash foo if they need cookies, and have more the pages where we're likely to have cross-site scripting be elsewhere, and that would seem to help, but it actually doesn't for reasons we'll talk about later. But it helps reading the cookies, but there's a workaround that the attacker will use. Okay. So we talked about some other mitigations. So one is that you just, because these cookies have this domain field, which is what matters, and they're typically the sensitive information we care about, you can just host the potentially dangerous stuff on a different domain. And this is something that pretty much all major people who host uploaded files do. So Google, Facebook, GitHub, they host their stuff from another domain often, which makes it so it doesn't matter if there's cross-site scripting as much, because at least you can't get the login to Google that way. And we have this thing called content security browser, where the server can say, hey browser, I know I might be sending you something with scripts, don't run them. And therefore not have to worry so much about whether they detected whether they're scripts and got rid of them by filtering appropriately. But our real solution, just like with normal command injection, is filtering and escaping our inputs. That's what we actually want to do. That's what you should do. There's not really an alternative to it. All these other solutions there's still things the attacker could do which are at least annoying that we probably don't want. We don't want the attacker putting big banners on our website, which none of these mitigations really stop. So we're going to want to filter and escape inputs. And like when we talked about escaping inputs for the shell, escaping inputs for HTML is notoriously difficult, which is probably the main reason why all these other mitigations exist. Because it's not like with SQL, where we have placeholders and we're done. People have often gotten into trouble trying to filter HTML, especially when they want to allow people to use HTML, but not dangerous HTML, which is a common thing people want. You might make a forum post, they want to let you use a little bit of HTML in that. And that means that they need to figure out how to only allow safe HTML. And this is easy to get wrong, and many sites have gotten it wrong. And this is because there's lots of weird things web browsers do, and just like there's weird things command lines do that you might not expect. Like, for example, you might say, well, all those examples I've seen, they have a script tag, so I just need to get rid of script tags. I mean, what's the worst that could happen if I just allow people to set an image URL? But it turns out there's this wonderful web browser feature where you could have a URL starting with JavaScript colon, even as the source for an image, and the web browser will run some JavaScript, even though it doesn't make any sense for that to be an image. It will do it. So you need to filter that out. You can't let people give you a URL for an image without filtering it. You might say, okay, well, all these attacks I've seen here have the word script in them, so I'm just going to get rid of the word script from all the input. Just make sure it doesn't appear. And then you'll run into trouble because, well, there's other ways you run JavaScript in HTML, like on error on an image is JavaScript code to run if you have an error loading the image. And you'll get into trouble there. So there's lots of subtleties with it, which is probably the reason why we have all these mitigations, because you have to be really careful to get this right. And the general strategy is that you're going to whitelist. You're going to say, these are things I know are definitely safe. You're going to say, I know HTTP URLs are definitely safe in images. And you're going to do that sort of strategy, but it's still pretty error prone because you need to be really careful if you don't really know how browsers work. Okay. So, and I mentioned this mitigation of HTTP-only cookies, which was the idea was that we'd make cookies not available to JavaScript. So injecting a command wouldn't let you get at cookies. So it seems like we're safe, right? So it's going to turn out that we're not. So what's probably the biggest issue with if we can't get at the cookie directly? What's probably our biggest problem with having people exploit the fact that we're logged in? And that we always send the cookie at least. So something we can do at least with injected cross-site scripting is that we can change the web page we're on. So we can add things to it. That's definitely something we can do. So maybe there's something dangerous we can do there. At the least, we can also read the web page we're on. So this isn't obvious. You don't often want to read your own web page from JavaScript because usually you already know it's there, but you can do that. So we could read the web page we're on. So if there's any information there, we might get it. But it's a little bit worse than that. But the first problem is going to be that we can read web page contents. So even if we have HTTP-only cookies, if you can't get at the login equivalent, you can still read everything on the web page. So that's bad. If you can have the web page be displaying something sensitive, you know, names or something like that, you could get at them, and you could send those instead of the login credentials. It's not as useful to the attacker, but it's still pretty bad. But it's actually more concerning than that. So I have a, I think it's JavaScript for this. It's probably this website. Yeah. So we can in fact read things from other web pages. So here, I'm going to show you the source code for this. Here I have an iframe that embeds a web page. The web page is called Local Secret, and I have some other JavaScript code that I also run. So in this web page, it says the secret code is foobar. So I have a secret code in some other web page that I'm just embedding in this web page. And I have some JavaScript that's not in the embedded web page that can run that can tell me the secret code. So it's reading from a different web page that just happens to be embedded. This is something you can actually do in JavaScript. And the way that looks in code here is that I run this function, which says, from my document, get the thing called local frame, which is right here. And that's where we're embedding this other web page. And from that, get the content it contains and get the thing called secret and tell me what's inside it. You can just do that. Yeah?
You have to know the element IDs though, right?
So the question is, you have to know the element IDs, right? Well, I could also have said .innerHTML here, right at the document. I can get the whole document if I want. I can get, or I can iterate through all the element IDs. So I don't actually need to know the element IDs, but it sure makes it easier, which is why my example does that. So that seems pretty bad for, you know, worrying about cross-site scripting. So we can put a web page in some other web page and read its contents. And if this just worked all the time, we'd be in a lot of trouble. Because let's say I put some other web page in, like this one. Right? So should I be able to read from this web page? Should I just embed it in some other web page? So why not? What would be wrong if I could do that? So this is Colab, for example. Then if you could do this, you could make me in my web browser visit your website and you could like read grades. That'd be really bad. So this better not be possible. And I have a similar link here, which tries to read from the Colab web page, and it doesn't work. So let's investigate why it doesn't work. We're taking out the good old JavaScript console here. So here's our Colab web page. I'm going to click this thing, which tries to read it, and we get this error message here. That content document thing, the contents of the frame, was null. So the web browser didn't let us do this. So it let us do it in one case, when I had this local secret.html, and not in the other one. Yeah? Yeah, so there's some sort of policy the web browser has that in some cases they think this is safe for me to do, and in some cases they think it's not safe for me to do. And the policy is something related to where the two files are. So in this case, this local secret was coming from the same server, And CoLab, obviously, is not hosted on this little testing server I have showing this web page. And the general policy is something called the same origin policy. So the idea is that if two web pages come from the same place, the web browser will let one of them do whatever it wants to the other if it's embedded. And this exists because we want to support various features that modern websites like. So modern websites like embedding some little mini window, loading content dynamically, reading that out and putting it in other parts of the web page, and allowing them to embed another part of the same website and read from it makes it possible to implement features like this. And that's why web browsers allow it. But it would be really bad to allow us to like read random other websites. So the policy basically is that if we have two pages, like one embedded in the other, from the same origin, scripts can do anything with anything. If they're from different origins, we are going to leak almost no information. Notice I couldn't get anything about the CoLab document there that was loaded. It just said, the whole thing is null. Sorry. You know, so this means that Facebook is not going to learn what you're doing on Google by embedding a little Google window at the bottom of Facebook, unless Google wants to let them do it. Yeah. So this is going to apply. So the question is, does same origin policy apply to AJAX requests? So AJAX requests are a way that scripts can request things from websites. And yes. And it's the same principle that we are embedding another web page in another in a website, but the mechanism for getting that other thing to embed is different. So if you know what AJAX requests are, it's the same principle that applies to AJAX requests applies to embedded iframes. So, yeah.
So since the policy
doesn't allow to have it for different servers, how can the technique be used for exploitation as a sort? So the question is, why is this a security concern for us? Okay. So first thing we'll look at is exactly what counts as the same origin. And wow, I have not been displaying any slides. Okay. There's this notion of same origin, but it's not maybe exactly this notion that you would have. So the origin is the part of the URL up to the server name. There are a few minor exceptions, but this is basically what it is. So notably, this means that if I can inject something in example.com foobar, I can read any other thing on example.com from that. That our cookie has this field restricting cookies to a certain path doesn't really do anything because we can just embed another part of the same origin and do whatever we want with it. So this is really what the sort of security boundaries we have between web pages. If you want two web pages to be independent from each other, they need to have different origins, because otherwise the browser is not going to enforce that one web page can't do whatever it wants to another just by embedding it and reading everything from it and all that. Yeah. So the part highlighted is the origin. So anything which would have the same highlighted part would have the same origin. So none of these have the same origin in this case. But if you change anything that's not highlighted, it's still the same origin. So if you change that slash foobar to anything else, still the same origin. These are all different origins. So it also matches imperfectly with your idea of what might be the same server, because HTTP and HTTPS are different, for example. That's just what the policy is. Yeah.
So what you're saying is if you have one URL on your server that's like vulnerable, everything.
Everything with the same domain name in the URLs, yes. At least as far as reading things from the web page. Yeah. And this is the big reason why places like Google were hosting their user content on a completely different domain name. because basically they can't put anything dangerous anywhere on google.com, doesn't matter where. Yeah.
I guess that's basically what I was gonna ask. Like, just, yeah. If I put something on my UVA website, I could then be any other UVA.
Yeah, modulo, some of the other mitigations maybe may help, but basically yes. Yes. So the question is, it doesn't matter if we're storing them on a different server because they're embedded in the same web page. So that's not quite the case. So to give an example, so in this example we had here, we're embedding Colab. By embedding the Colab website, I did not let the Colab website manipulate this web page beyond that box there. So there are safe ways of embedding things from another server where you don't have to worry about that. And this is another part of what the browser is enforcing when it enforces the same origin policy. So it's letting us do embedding, but it's guaranteeing that information doesn't leak in either direction.
So we have to use something like an iframe to actually, you have to actually embed comments in an iframe
then. Yes, so if you wanted to handle comments this way, you need to do something like embed the iframe in, embed the comments in an iframe or something like that. Or use or rely on one of the other mitigations we talked about, like content security policy, to make there be no scripts or something like that. Which means that, yeah, you can't always get away with that separate domain strategy. So because of the same origin, as we've seen, it's very hard to safely share a domain name. You need to be really careful. You can't set up other thing. Note that one server can serve multiple domain names, because in the HTTP request, we have a host name, so you can know what domain name it is. So you don't have to have multiple servers, you just have to have multiple names for your server.
Is that to protect against places that host a lot of websites?
Question is, can we host multiple names on the same server?
No, is the fact that different names are considered different origins maybe specifically to protect places that host a lot of websites, you know, like UCS or UGET?
So the question is, was this policy chosen to protect places that host multiple websites? I mean, that probably was a consideration, but the main reason to use the name is that the browser can easily determine what's the name. And many websites are hosted on multiple servers, even though it's one name. And you want that to be sensible. So the name is probably the right boundary. You know, it would be kind of nicer if we could like divide up different parts of our website into different origins, but we can't really do that. So the same origin policy is probably the most important thing security-wise that your browser does. And if we didn't implement it, we'd be in a ton of trouble. And to give an example, there was a bug where Apple has an IM client that has a web browser embedded to display messages. And they, because it was just displaying a local UI, didn't have the same origin policy turned on. They embedded a fully functional web browser with the same origin policy off. And the bug was that you could have a malicious link in an IM. It would be displayed in this mini web browser, which displayed your IMs. And if you clicked on that link, it would do something for the attacker. And it could, in fact, send your message logs to the attacker. And this was an example of sort of both cross-site scripting and not having the same origin policy to save you, to make it at least not so bad when you had cross-site scripting. So the cross-site scripting was that you could embed scripts in IMs, which is not supposed to be able to happen. And the way this happened is they allowed links in IMs, and they checked whether links were okay by just saying, does it look like a link? So for example, that looks like a link. It has a something followed by a colon slash slash, looks like a link. And JavaScript colon is this weird URL scheme, which runs a script when you go to it. We saw that with the earlier image example, and it worked here. So you could run JavaScript code when someone clicked on a link in IAM. As long as the link was formatted to kind of look like a normal link, normal HTTP link. And because there was no same origin policy being enforced, the JavaScript could request the file which contains your message logs, just as by naming its URL, like you look at local files in your web browser. And that, because same origin policy wasn't being enforced, just worked. So, example of why we really care about browsers supporting the same origin policy, you'd be in a lot more trouble than just messing up some websites. Because you can actually access local things. So it's very important that we have this on in our browsers. So we have this same origin policy, and we know that some operations sort of require same origin that we've shown. So some things, as long as the browser's working correctly, it's not going to let web pages interfere with each other. But we know that this doesn't always happen. So there's some things where we can not care about the origin. So one example was images. So earlier, when I talked about getting a cookie off a server with cross-site scripting, our example was loading an image from an attacker server. And that was allowed. We could load an image, we could even display an image from a different website, even if they're not from the same origin. And there's various other exceptions like this. And there's kind of this fuzzy line about whether this is the sort of right boundary to cross, say, whether we should always allow certain things or not. So one thing we can do is we can load images from random other websites. And images we can get more information out of than web pages. So we can load an image and find out, did it load successfully? How big is it? How much space does it take up on my web page? This is the sorts of things we can find out. And we can load audio and video and maybe find out how long it is or something like that. Even though this is getting us information about something from another web server. And we can even load scripts. That seems pretty bizarre. We can load whole scripts that other web pages might use. We just can't get some detailed errors out of them, which was just sort of the stopgap measure to keep us from using the error messages to figure out what's really on this and if it's not a script. So let's look at this first innocent little example. So loading images from other websites. So is this something we should allow, first of all? So you're nodding your head, so why? Okay, so it's convenient. I don't want to copy my images over. Yeah, and so. Other opinions? Yeah.
Isn't that exactly what Google Images is?
Doesn't Google Images just do this all the time? Yeah. So seems very convenient. So yeah.
There's also the point that if you don't do this, you only set a copy onto your server and updates from there on their
end. Yeah. So and it's nice to be able to embed something nicely and have it update automatically. So I note that this policy here. It doesn't require the same origin. This includes cases where the place hosting the image didn't make a decision here. That they just have an image that they may have not intended to be embedded elsewhere, but it's still allowed. That's what the policy is. Unless they take a very explicit measure to stop it, it's going to work on another website. So I'm going to give an example of how we can do something which many of you might consider an abuse of this policy. So I'm going to digress into a feature the Facebook website has. So Facebook has this login page, which takes a next URL. This is because when you click on a link in Facebook and you aren't logged in, they want you to display a login page and then go to some URL. And if you are logged in, it doesn't display a login page for you, it just goes directly to that URL. Just tells your web browser, request this URL instead. And I believe they limit this to Facebook URLs. So at least you can't get at Yeah, you can't make this redirect to random websites. So one thing we can do is we can say, you know, Facebook has some images on it. For example, they have something which is the little icon in the corner. When you go to Facebook and you see in your browser, there's a little F icon. That's this image here. And we can just load that image via the login script. We can say, the image link is, you know, log into Facebook, but if you're all logged in, it will redirect to the image. So what this link will do is if you're logged into Facebook, your browser requests this URL, Facebook gets your cookie, it says, you're logged in, you want to go to this page, which is faveicon.ico. And then your browser goes there, it loads the image, everything's good. If you're not logged into Facebook, your browser asks facebook.com for the login page, and it gets a login page. Well, that's not an image, so your browser tries to display it as an image, says, nope, doesn't work. And we can have some JavaScript which runs and detects, did this image load or not? This is something we are allowed to do with someone embedding an image. And based on whether this image loaded or not, we know whether someone is in the same browser logged into Facebook, even though we're not supposed to be able to read things from Facebook.com. It also turns out this trick works for a whole lot of other websites. So seems like the sort of thing that maybe we shouldn't be allowing. But the question is, like, what policy should we change? Or is it Facebook that should be doing something?
What harm can you actually do with it?
So all you can really tell is whether someone's logged in. If you had some more other conditional redirects, you might imagine worse things. So let's say, for example, Facebook had an image you could only load if you were in a certain Facebook group. That would reveal whether you were in that group or not. But that's not the sort of thing that people have typically found. It's usually just, are you logged in or not? So whether that's harmful, hard to say. Other opinions, questions? Yeah.
Can't you, maybe not let JavaScript check it?
So the question is, can we just not let JavaScript check if the image is loading? So yeah, we could try to do that. It's kind of tricky. So let's say we don't let JavaScript check if the image is loaded. There's this sort of backdoor solution where we effectively ask the user whether the image is loaded by making the image really big and having something appear or not appear based on whether it's taking up the space, for example. And there are other things like that we can do. So that's probably not an effective solution. It would help. And it's sort of useful to know if images don't load. Yeah. Okay, so we could have a policy where you just can't have redirects for images, which might be inconvenient if we have some funny way of getting in images, but would solve this problem. Other solutions? Maybe we could only do that for cross-origin. You know, if it's not same origin.
Implement a way where Facebook could send back a response saying, we don't want you to look at this image.
Yeah, so Facebook, definitely, we could have a way where Facebook takes the initiative and says, you shouldn't load images through this. And that's something Facebook probably could do. But yeah, so this is a tricky problem to solve. But this is sort of an information leak we are often allowing by permitting some operations to cross origins. That, you know, we're deliberately letting information go between different websites. So another sort of example of something similar, which was more of a privacy concern and has been fixed, is with the innocent operation of letting you link to another website. So as you may know, browsers display visited links by default differently than unvisited links. And you can customize the style of visited links in HTML. And you can ask the browser, what does this element, what does this link or whatever look like? What styles does it have? Is it colored red? Is it colored blue? And this used to be something that browsers allowed, even if this color red here was based on whether or not you visited a link. So this is way more disturbing than are you logged into Facebook or not? Because now we can just choose any URL, so like for some secret Facebook group or various other things that are way more sensitive, because you can just choose some random URL on some website that might be incriminating or something like that, and find out whether you visited. And just like we could have like the iframe be invisible, you could actually do this by having the links be basically not visible on the page anywhere, like hidden below where you can't see it, and you could still ask for this information. So this was way worse than are you logged into Facebook, and the browsers took measures to fix it. So how would you fix this problem? So the problem here is that these two things are styled differently, and we can ask which one, which color is this link? Yeah. Okay, so we could only display links differently if we've clicked on it from the particular page. So this is making our visited link functionality less useful. But at least, you know, making it still kind of useful and getting rid of the problem. Any other solutions? Yeah. Okay, so just say you can't get the computed style. So the question is, why do we care about, why does this functionality exist? So anything to think of, why would the people who implemented the HTML standard have decided that it's useful for scripts to get the computed style of an element? Yeah. Okay, well, so we could do that sort of functionality. There's cases where links aren't involved is probably the better way of thinking about it. We might want to do this. Yeah?
And then I want to change what the message is, depending on if you visited the site already or not.
Sorry, there's cases where we aren't finding out whether you've visited the site or not, where we want to still get this computed style. The question is, why does this get computed style exist? And this seems like a kind of useful functionality for it, but it is not why it was invented. Yeah.
What about like if you adjust the text size or something, would that be part of the style? Like if you make the text on your web pages bigger?
Yes, that would be part of the style. So one example of a non-link use, the link uses are fine, would be, let's say we had a button to change the text size on our website. We want to figure out what's the current text size, how can I make it bigger? So that would be an example where we might want this get computed style functionality. And there's other cases, because we can also query with this properties like width. So you can say, how wide is this? I want to put something right below it. So there is various uses for get computed style, which is why it exists. It wasn't made to let people query whether links were visited, because you would make a completely different API for that. Yeah? Yeah, so we could maybe just disable get computed style on links. That would be an option. And that's kind of similar to what the browsers actually did. They took a more subtle approach. So get computed style computes the style as if the link is unvisited and returns that value. So it lies. And they also disallow types of formatting where you might be able to figure it out from other things on the page. So they don't allow the visited style to like change the font size, because that would mess up where other elements are placed, and you could figure that out by asking where is this on the page. And this is sort of the solution that browsers have implemented. It's probably not complete, because there's still sorts of things you could imagine doing by having users behave differently depending on whether like a link is visible because it's either like white or black or something like that against a white background. But at least it prevents automated easy querying of here's a giant list of URLs, did you visit all of them? Like what secret Facebook groups have you visited? Okay. And so there's another important operation here, which is less subtle and less easy to fix than these others, that's allowed between origins, and that's submitting forms that go to other web pages. So we can have a form like where we enter in like a comment or something. You can put that on any web page. And in the HTML, you say, where do you want the browser to send this? And you can specify any URL, and the browser doesn't care. It will send the form wherever. The assumption is it's just sending a command. The website we're going to can figure out what to do about it. And this is useful sometimes. Like if you want to embed Google search for your domain, you can do that. You can have a form that submits to Google. But it also means that if you're one of these other web pages, you have to be very careful. So people could have a form on another website which gets submitted either when someone clicks a completely innocent looking button or even just automatically. And that form might do something you don't want it to do. So probably the worst example I've heard of this is that in 2007, Gmail had functionality for doing email filters. So who here has used email filters in Gmail or something? Yeah. And so one of the options in an email filter on Gmail at the time is forward everything that matches this filter to another email address. And to create an email filter, you basically visited a web page where there was a form where you entered like the email address, some other flags, and click submit. And at the time in 2007, you could just reproduce this form on your own website, where you just say, submit not to my website, but to Google. And you could just pre-fill in all the fields with the make a new email filter values and an email address that say your email address. And you don't even have to have a submit button. You can just have some JavaScript run that effectively clicks the submit button for you whenever someone visits your web page. And this is just sending a request to Google. And Google will get the request from the user's web browser. And the user's web browser is going to happily send all the cookies that apply to that request. And the web browser remembers, oh, I have this cookie for google.com. Here it is. Oh, and here's the rest of the form that I was told to send. And it will just send this. And in 2007, this would create an email filter whenever you visited this web page, if you were logged into Google Mail. Yeah.
Where is that URL?
Which one?
Google.
Here. It's in the action field of the form.
Like, how would the attacker get that URL?
Apparently, at the time, it was static. It seems like a random thing, but it would just work with that. This was obviously fixed very quickly, because it's really bad. Sort of an example that even sort of people who really should know about what they're doing could fall to prey to this. So what's the solution to this problem? Yeah? Yeah. So we just need to have some information so the attacker can't make this form. So the form needs to contain something like some random code that's actually random and checked that keeps the attacker from making up the form. Okay, so this attack in general is called cross-site request forgery. And you can, one way of describing it is that it's taking advantage of the ambient authority of the user. That just by being near the user, you have authority to do stuff because those cookies are sent. And the problem is that, you know, the cookie is what we're treating as this is a real request. But it doesn't tell us that. The cookie just tells us it's the user's web browser. It doesn't tell us the user authorized this request. And we want cookies to still work that way. We can't just not send cookies from requests that come from a different web server, because we want you to be able to click a link on a website, you know, and be logged in. So we can't just not ever send cookies on cross-origin requests. So we have this scenario where the request is chosen by the attacker and some action happens. So one defense against CSRF is the thing I mentioned last time when I was talking about trusting clients. That one thing you might do, if you wanted to know whether they submitted it from your website for real, is you check this misspelled referrer header, where the browser tells you, this is where I got this thing to send to you. And in the previous case, it didn't work because we were worried about the attacker's browser. But here, it's a legitimate user's browser, so presumably, the user is not going to let someone steal their cookies and send the wrong referrer, right? The browser, it's not something the browser's going to do, because it's working on behalf of the user, and the user wants to tell the website honestly, where did I get this for? So one thing we could do is that here we can actually check the referrer header and say, okay, yeah, it's really from the same website. The problem with this idea is that the referrer header is just not always sent. It's sometimes sent, it's not consistently sent, and there are websites it just won't be sent from that the attacker could make the form be on. So the typical solution is what was described earlier, of just adding something secret, something often called a CSRF token, because it's defending against CSRF. And the key attribute here is that the attacker can't figure out what it is. They can't make a form that has the token because they have no idea what the token is for a particular user. So the token needs to be different for each user because the attacker can read their form and they can produce a copy of that, but that's not something they'll want to do. They want to produce a copy that's valid for a different user. So as long as that different user has a different token, they can't do that. Yeah.
Is there a reason why you can't just say, like, if there wasn't a referrer,
just ignore it? So question is, can we just ignore requests without referrers? So part of the problem is that some web browsers don't send referrers as a policy, or some proxies that web browsers might use, like in a company, won't send referrers as a policy. So there are some legitimate cases where browsers just don't send it. There are some types of requests which contain something equivalent always. This is something which happens with AJAX, when certain types of requests JavaScript makes will always have some indication of where they came from, but it doesn't happen for normal form submissions. But yeah, if you could trust it, if you don't care about those cases where it doesn't work, you could just require a referrer. So CSRF is extremely kind of subtle, because it's usually not something you think about. You don't think about someone filling out your form who's not your user, but getting to act as your user. But that's what CSRF is. It's this scenario where the user goes to the attacker's website, the attacker chooses the request that they make. And you need to defend against that by making it so the attacker can't construct the right request. And as you can see from Gmail screwing up, that this is something that's pretty easy to mess up. There's also one special case of CSRF I'd like to talk about. So beyond normal forms that you think of, one particular case where you can have CSRF, which a lot of places miss because they make a CSRF token per user, is login forms. So you can log a, so sometimes if you don't protect your login form by having a secret token, someone can make a user be logged into a different account. And this is actually a problem. So can anyone think of how this might be a problem? What would be an example where you wouldn't want an attacker to log you into the wrong account? Yeah. Yeah, so a good example, yeah, is sort of online shopping sort of thing. They log you into your account, their account, you enter your credit card information, save the credit card, and now they have it. So this is something you also need to worry about. And this is something that people have often missed because a common strategy for making a CSRF token was to make it something unique per user. And if you're not logged in, you don't have a user. It's not good enough. So a typical strategy is to make it something that's like the session ID or something like that. Okay, so There's one, well, any questions about CSRF beyond talked about? Yeah. So the question is, how do we choose when we generate a new CSRF token, right? So a typical strategy is to set a cookie to a random value if it's not already set, and otherwise the value of that cookie is the CSRF token. That's an example of a strategy that works. So it's unique for the web browser. There are other things you can do too. That's one simple possibility. Yeah?
The token.
Question is, can't the attacker read the CSRF token? So they can read their CSRF token. The question is, can they read one for another user? So how would they do that? Any ideas about what we'd be worried about them doing?
Could you possibly do the iframes like from before?
So could we do it with an iframe? So no, because of the same origin policy. We'll get that content document as null error if we try, because the attacker's website is not the same. So the victim website. If we had cross-site scripting, though, we could. So it wouldn't matter if it wasn't in the cookie, we could read it. But yeah, since it's different origins, that should protect us from having it read, provided we don't put it like in an image, in like as the image width or something. That'd be a problem. But as long as it's one of those things that we're not supposed to be able to get from another website, it should be secret. So that's sort of the folly of letting you sort of submit forms on other web pages. So this is one of those operations which is allowed between different web pages, and the way we get around that is by making it so they would also need to read stuff from other web pages in order to send the right form. So they can submit a form, but not the right one. So there's another problem, which is just with iframes. Something we can do, and I have a demo for this, is we can, as you can see here, we can embed web pages in other web pages. And we can do a bit more fancy things than that. So, you know, here we have these ugly frames around the web page. We can get rid of those. We can make it look cleaner. And something else we can do is we can even make it translucent. So we can have this translucent web page back here, and I can put something in front of it. Or I can just make it invisible. So here I have a web page, which is, so if I can open. So here I have a web page which has a link for me to do a dangerous thing. Right there. Okay, and that's in this little frame here. And on top of it, just placed directly on top of it, I have something from the web page that's embedding it. This is something you can actually do in a web page. You can have things on top of each other. And I just did this by using some saying position absolutes and specifying a location for the thing on top of it and for the actual embedded web page. So I have here a link that's right on top of the button, and I've also said that the iframe is on top of this even though it's translucent. So if I click here, it actually will try to submit that link, web page. I'll just get rid of this. And I can do that with a link here. It's the same setup, but I've just made the, instead of making it, here it's translucent, here I have the same setup, I've just made the iframe, the embedded web page, be completely translucent, transparent. But this link here actually clicks a button. Because there's a button placed right there, you just can't see it. And this is just because I can embed another web page in here and put it in front of my web page and make it transparent, or put, you know, things that are only shown but not clickable in front of them. And even if I couldn't make the thing clickable, like I could change where it is immediately before you click or something like that. So the attack here is that I can sort of hide, you know, make the other web page, you know, not visible, transparent, or I can make it just only show up when you get your mouse really, really close to clicking the link. And have you click some button on some other web page that I don't control. It doesn't matter that I can't read that web page. I just need to know where is the thing I want you to click and have you click it. And I can do basically the same sorts of things I was doing with CSRF, as long as I know where are the things I want you to click on. So how should web browsers or websites defend against this? What would be some good mechanisms to have? Or are there questions about the problem? Yeah. Okay, yeah, so a simple policy is that that if you have two things on top of each other, we shouldn't let this button here be clickable. That is partially hidden, because it's partially hidden. So that would be a good policy. And there have been attempts to implement this sort of as a web browser policy. It's really hard to do well, because something I could do in JavaScript is I can figure out where's my mouse at any time. That's something I can find out in JavaScript. And I could do something like, as soon as I get right here, hide the link and make it so the iframe is the only thing visible. So we could say maybe try not to allow that, and that might be a reasonable solution. But because of that, because of that sort of problem, I think that's why this is typically not the approach that people have taken to dealing with this issue, though there are attempts to, say, make it so you can't click on things that, you know, have something overlaid in front of them. Yeah?
I'm just wondering if there are any benefits for having transparent
buttons. So yeah, why are we allowed to make another web page translucent on top of one? I don't know. It's sort of a natural consequence of being allowed to make anything translucent. It's the same syntax, but yeah, maybe we should just not allow that. Maybe, is it useful enough? Okay. Other ideas on what we should do about this? Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we can keep them completely separate. We can say, once you've placed an iframe, you can't put anything in front of it. That part of the browser window is owned by that iframe for all time. That would be a policy we could have. Web browsers haven't seen fit to do that, but that would be quite a reasonable way of dealing with this. It still probably wouldn't quite work, because I can make this iframe really only this size, only cover the button area. But it would help, certainly, make this harder to pull off. If I have to have it visible and also own that part of the page, so I can't like put stuff on top of it. So the mitigations that happen in practice usually have not focused on changing how things are displayed. And this is probably partly because browsers are really afraid of breaking websites. And if you implement any of the mitigations you describe, which seem like good ideas, that you're probably going to break some website somewhere. And when that happens, Google is going to get a bug report, even though they can say, yeah, really, we're making it's safer for you. Yeah, Google's going to get a bug report, and they're going to say Chrome doesn't work. And Google's going to undo the mitigation, because they care about people not switching away. So the main mitigations that exist are that websites can tell browsers, please don't embed this web page in another web page. So there's for example, a value of the content security policy header, where in addition to saying whether or not you can run scripts, we can say, can you embed this? Where can this be embedded from? So this policy, frame ancestors, meaning things outside of me, have to come from the same place. That's what that says. You can send something like that, and that will prevent this sort of attack from happening. And another mitigation is that if you have JavaScript running in the iframe, you can like detect, are you in an iframe? You can ask things like that, and like make the button not work or something like that. That's less reliable. Okay. So any questions about sort of clickjacking here? So this is called clickjacking because we're taking a click that seems to be meant for like that innocent link there and giving it to someone else. And this is a harder attack because it's a UI attack. It's not the case that we're allowing sharing of this sort other than just displaying web pages and web pages, which is something we want to allow for like the Google Calendar widget on the course web page. Okay. So another thing with the same origin policy is that sometimes it's too much. So many websites want to do things which seem to not be allowed by the same origin policy. So for example, Facebook has a way where you can use your Facebook credentials to log into another website. And this is some sort of information sharing which seems to not be the sort contemplated by same origin policy. But this is sort of deliberate sharing, so how do we make that happen? So we're going to make that happen, make that cooperate with the same origin policy, and we're going to do it in a way which is actually, you know, doesn't actually need any extra browser features. So the way you typically implement something like this is by deliberately taking advantage of the features of that didn't require same origin before, like linking to websites and submitting forms to other websites. So here's an example where we're going to take advantage of these things which let us do bad things to do some deliberate sharing. And that's how something like Facebook login is implemented. So a typical implementation of something like that is that you go to some website where you want to log in using Facebook, and they get their own session ID. So they set up a session, they have their own cookie, completely independent from Facebook or whatever, you know, social network you're using to log into it, cookie, and they tell your browser to go to the social network site to log in. And they give it a URL or a form submission which says, hey, I'm logging in from example.com. Then your browser goes to the social network site and sends the cookie that it has previously for the social network site. And this is fine, even though it's a request that example.com is making, because we want that to happen, and that's the policy we have already, which got us into trouble before. But here it's a good thing. This way, social network can know, okay, you're trying to log into this other website, and I know who you are. And then it can send back a response saying, here's some information I'm going to give you to tell example.com who you are. So it can give you this sort of token to pass to example.com. So it can know you're logged in. And this is the typical way of doing what is called single sign-on. You have one website that lets you sign into other websites where we're sharing this information about who you are, but doing it in a controlled way where we aren't just reading other websites. We aren't just having everything on the same domain and having all your information be shared. So this token here, that's a bit of a tricky part. So what can the token be? Can we just put the username in the token? Not enough. Why not? Okay, so the username might not uniquely identify. Can we put like our email address in the token? Can that just be the token? Yeah. Sorry? Anyone can know that, yeah. So the problem, so this token needs to be something that we can't just make up. So a typical thing that you do in this is that behind the scenes, example.com would send the token itself, not through your browser, but maybe through your browser, to the social network site to verify who is this. And the social network site would remember, okay, I made this token for logging into example.com, so I'm going to give the identity to example.com. based on that. So that would be an example of a way of doing this. And now example.com knows it learned from social network who you are, so it doesn't have to worry that your browser was some attacker's browser and was lying, because they can't make up a token that a social network will verify. So this is an example sort of where, despite the same origin policy, we still have our deliberate sharing. We still have websites which do fancy things, even though they're across different origins. So that's still something that we can allow. So this is even with sort of the old web, even before we have any sort of special JavaScript stuff. You know, this is all, there's no JavaScript here even. This is all stuff that we could implement before. In the modern world, we also sometimes want to do things which are a bit more sophisticated than that, where it seems like we do run into trouble with the same origin policy. We can't have this workaround where we pass links back and forth easily, like the Google Translator API. How do we actually, do we send a link with the whole web page in it as a token? That seems kind of awkward. So a modern exception is that there are explicit mechanisms where servers can opt in to say, I don't want care about the same origin policy for this. And maybe this is what we should have been doing in the first place. Maybe we should have enforced it for images and for posts of submitting forms and all that. Maybe we should support done it all the time, except if we had an explicit message saying, don't do same origin for this. But that's not the web we started with. So that's not how things work. But for some types of requests, we actually check this. So for things which would ordinarily violate same origin, like reading the contents of a web page, there's a way of saying, yes, I want to allow this because, say, for example, this is my translator API. I want the other web page to be able to embed the translated text. Okay, and we have about 3 minutes left. So I guess in a I'll conclude with a brief talk on sort of a completely different aspect of security. So all the things we've looked at today are based on, we have some website and we trust that website. And that website wants to be able to work with a browser to actually know that the browser is doing the things that the user actually wants. But there's sort of a different area of web security and that people are concerned about, which is privacy, where usually the website is not on the same side. And the biggest issue here is user tracking. So websites, just like they can cooperate to let you log in, they can cooperate to track who you are across multiple websites. So for example, let's say a website has an iframe with a Google ad. Well, Google gets to learn, if that website cooperates, who embedded the iframe. The website can just say, I'm embedding this Google ad from this website. And your browser sends Google cookies to retrieve that embedded little iframe with an ad. And now Google has a web history of like most of your website accesses, assuming lots of websites have Google ads. And this is understandably, something that users don't like, but it's because websites are cooperating with Google. So there's no same origin policy problem here, because this is sort of explicitly allowed by all the websites involved. But this is something browsers want to do something about. So how can we deal with this problem? Yeah. Sorry, you can just start. Yeah, you can start.
You could make up cookies, I guess, so like if you know it's always going to Google Ads, you can send them a cookie of like a very temporary user that you created.
Okay, we could just detect this situation and send a different cookie. Or no cookie. Yeah. Yeah. So
you can do like an ad blocker and just not load it.
We can try to figure out when they're ads in general and just never load them. Yeah. And so one of these policies is something people track. So one policy is no third-party cookies, that we only send cookies to the main web page you're displaying. And yeah, you might embed something else, and we'll just not send cookies for those. Now, this is not perfect. You know, so now let's say I have an embedded Google Calendar and I want to edit it. I can't do that because I'm not sending the cookies which make me logged into Google anymore. And there's other ways you're going to break real websites by doing this. But this is a policy that many real web browsers try to implement. And another policy, which maybe is less error-prone, is we can have a list of bad things. So you can just say, here are what ads look like. I'm not going to send cookies for those. And this is something that people really do implement, but obviously they can just change what the ads are called, ad web servers are called, and break it. Yeah?
That's why things like Adblock and Adblock Plus can register a new ad
at time. Yes, so this is, but yeah. So, but it's sort of a cat and mouse game, just like we had with malware. And I think that's all the time I have for today. So.